Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. There once was a man named Arthur Stillwell who was a pretty big deal around here. How big a deal? Well, there's the Stillwell Building in downtown Kansas City, the town of Stillwell, Kansas, and of course, Port Arthur, Texas, named for its founder, Arthur Stillwell. Arthur Stillwell was a lot of things, but for our purposes today, he was a railroad man and is credited today with building 2,300 miles of track, founding more than 40 cities, and having a whole lot to do with one of Kansas City's most venerable businesses, Kansas City Southern. Today, the history of railroading in Kansas City as seen through the life of Arthur Stillwell. With us is a man more than just a little qualified to talk about Arthur Stillwell, because Landon Rowland is one of Stillwell's successors as the head of Kansas City Southern. Besides that, Landon Rowland is chairman emeritus of Janus Capital Group, and it's a pleasure to have him here today. Landon, welcome back to Up to Date.
Thank you, Steve.
This was one extraordinary man.
Indeed he was.
Tell us about him.
He was the grandson of one of the founding fathers of the Erie Canal, and he learned from that antecedent how important to the development of Midwestern farmers access to eastern ports was. And frankly, it didn't happen in the United States until somebody early in the 19th century. And some of you have heard of Albert Gallatin, but he was Jefferson's Secretary of the Treasury.
That's right.
He's the fellow that decided that we needed a national transportation plan. Jefferson said, write one up. And in 1809, he came up with this plan that said we need highways, we need canals,
mm-hmm.
we need a way for people to bring merchandise to our ports. And thereafter, by 1825, we had the Erie Canal. But it taught everybody that we had to have good transportation to open up the middle of the United States. It had a curse, however, Steve, and that was that everybody thought you had to bring this merchandise to eastern ports. Nothing was done in particular about ports on the Gulf.
Hmm.
There weren't any to speak of except New Orleans. And, of course, at that time, we didn't have anything on the West Coast connecting the United States.
So Kansas City might be a very different town today if not for Arthur Stillwell.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a terribly complicated thing to throw at your attentive listeners, and there are many in this audience who know a lot about Stillwell and know a lot about railroads. In fact, that's one of the great things about being in the railroad family is that so many people follow and study railroading, its antecedents, its progress, its outlook. So whatever I say, I want you to take account of people in your audience who will have their own observations and quite important ones to make. Arthur Stillwell was an entrepreneur, an innovator. He started out with a business in which he worked in a hotel in St. Louis.
I was going to say he started out nothing to do with railroading whatsoever,
no,
right?
No, absolutely right. He started out working in a hotel in St. Louis. Got a job as a result of some connection with a relative. Does that sound familiar? He then decided to start an advertising business for railroads because railroads did not have printed timetables. So he decided they needed printed timetables. Now, just think about the small innovation of printed timetables for railroads in which he sold advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Does this sound like Facebook?
Yeah.
This is the kind of thing that Stillwell saw immediately the connection between something like a needed service for the company, but also an opportunity for communicating with users.
But he started off, as you point out, he worked in New York as a floor walker at a novelty store. He
yes.
bought a printing plant eventually. But clearly this was a man who just had a knack for business and how things sort of worked out there.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
His instinct for business led him into the insurance business, and he developed some very interesting products for the 19th century that were essentially to facilitate saving for retirement using life insurance wrappers. This was
because he saw people paying insurance every month until the day they died
yes.
and not getting anything out of it. And he thought, this doesn't make any sense to me. So he really changed that business.
He did. He made it possible for people to pay into an insurance kind of product and then draw out of the product after they retired the money needed to make. Well, this is all before Social Security, you see, so
mm-hmm.
this product was much more valuable than it might have been conceived. One thing you might say about Stillwell, you in your opening remarks, you talked about Kansas City Southern. I don't think anybody here who is a stockholder of Janus Capital today should be without the knowledge that that is essentially Stillwell Financial Services, mm-hmm. which was created when we separated in roughly 2000 the railroad
right.
activities of Kansas City Southern from the financial services activities. The financial services activities were put together in a company called Stillwell Financial Services in honor of Arthur Stillwell and his financial services background. After we went along for a while, it was clear that everybody connected the company with Janus as the main engine for the enterprise, and so we decided to simply change the name mm-hmm. of Stillwell Financial to Janus Capital. And so that is today the company that survives and goes along. I'm sure there are people in the audience who are shareholders of that, perhaps not knowing that the company was originally named for this man that you've celebrated here this morning, Arthur Stillwell.
We're visiting with Landon Roland today about the life of Arthur Stillwell, who put Kansas City on the map when it came to railroading. You know, you gave a talk on him a number of years ago, and one thing that came out in that, any number of things did, and you'll be speaking again, I should point out, 2 p.m. Sunday, March 18th at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the branch downtown 14 West 10th Street. But we talked here about him starting off working as a floor walker at a novelty store in New York, but something else was going on with him because even as a boy, he had been dreaming of building a railroad. So clearly the seed was there even before he sort of launched off into the world at large.
That's right? Exactly right. And his connection with transportation through his grandparents. His father was not particularly active in business. Arthur was closer to his grandfather, and it was his grandfather that taught him most of what he knew about transportation needs. The object of Stillwell always was, it seems to me, to take advantage of infrastructure opportunities that somebody else had overlooked, whether that infrastructure was financial services for retirement, whether it was for the timing of railroad transportation, ultimately for reorganizing the railroad tracks that he found in a particular place. It wasn't until after the Civil War that we were able to get away from the local monopolies that railroad builders prior to roughly 1890 had perfected. Mm-hmm. The first railroad operators wanted to keep the traffic on their systems as long as possible. They did not want to turn it over to anybody else, even if it was more efficient to do so. Stillwell came to Kansas City, found a man here who had an idea for a terminal railroad, which at that time was relatively novel. We will build a railroad that will serve all the businesses in an area, and they will turn over the traffic to the most suitable, most appropriate carrier, most efficient carrier. And he was building his railroad. At night, his competitor, the Missouri Pacific, tore the tracks up. So Arthur had to come back in the daytime, rebuild the track. This went on for some time, this contest, but it was not unusual at that time. Railroad wars were very common, and Arthur managed to overcome this disadvantage. I don't want to call him Arthur, but let's say Mr. Stillwell overcame these disadvantages by getting the protection of the court. Someone said he had to find a congenial judge because most of the judges seemed to be more partial to the Missouri Pacific and other established lines. It's back to the importance of the rule of law in supporting innovation in business.
We started off, Landon, talking about him as being a creature of New York. How did he get to Kansas City? Why did he come here to begin with?
He came here initially to participate in a printing plant operation. That printing plant operation was flooded out in one of those periodic floods that came over Kansas City in the 19th and early 20th centuries. It was only later that he came back with the idea that he would invest in Kansas City companies that were here under a company called the Guardian Trust. He created, in essence, an investment company called the Guardian Trust, which he was then going to use to buy companies that seemed to have promise in what he thought was a uniquely a town with unique potential as he saw the country developing, as he saw the growth of the country.
And people would invest in this thinking that this guy has this thing figured out. We're going to ride this thing for a while.
To a great extent. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, succeeds with his terminal railroad and with his partner, whose name escapes my mind now, he begins to go south, acquiring or putting railroads together that got as far as the coal fields of eastern Kansas.
Pittsburgh, Kansas,
absolutely.
Joplin, Missouri, right?
Bringing coal to Kansas City for the fuel and energy needs of this growing metropolitan area.
He did something else that was interesting to me because he did a lot of studying. This is a guy who clearly was a thinker and spent some time looking around him and seeing what was going on. And he was concerned that farmers were really struggling back in those days financially, at least in part because of transportation costs. What conclusions did he come up with on that point?
Well, Brandon? He concluded that if Kansas City could get to the Gulf of Mexico, if we could have a straight line, straight shot to the Gulf of Mexico, we could improve export opportunities for farmers.
The world would open up more competition. They would be benefiting.
They would be
from benefit, that.
And Kansas City as a city would benefit from this. But don't want to be too idealistic about this, Steve. This is a guy that proceeded in bits and pieces. He goes to Hume. He goes to Pittsburgh, Kansas, for coal. He then finds out that we're opening up all these forest product opportunities in Arkansas, in eastern Oklahoma, in Louisiana, and we have building booms going on in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in Chicago, in other cities of the upper Midwest, and this low-cost forest products business was a natural for a railroad if he could connect his railroad from Kansas City into Fort Smith, Arkansas, Texarkana, keeping on going south, and it was at this point that he decided, I'm going to go to Shreveport, Louisiana, and then I'm going to go to the Gulf of Mexico. It took him a while.
And he's building track to get this done, right?
Well, he's not building track. He's acquiring partners who want to see their railroads combined into a more successful, a surviving investment entity. So I think it's he built a lot of track, but one thing you must remember about Kansas City Southern, it was not a land-grant railroad. It received no government subsidies. There are some maps that some of your listeners have seen that show how much land was set aside by the United States government in its financing of railroads. And one must also not forget that we wouldn't have railroads in this country but for United States government investment and local government investment. Mm-hmm. Local governments built these small railroads that still will amalgamated into this emerging railroad called the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Gulf. And he gets to Port Arthur in 1896. He's brought from people he's met in Holland, he's brought Dutch farmers to Port Arthur to farm. He's developed a fabulous port opportunity, and he's well on his way to the kind of property that one would expect of a modern railroad. He decides, this is now the 1890s, he decides he wants to go north. He wants to connect Kansas City to Chicago and Omaha, where the Transcontinental Railroad is. To his amazement, he finds that he has people resisting him, as they resisted other things he did. The competitors found that he was an upstart. As an upstart, he had to take a back seat. That was not Stillwell's way. And so he acquired properties to take him to Quincy and then to Chicago and then to Omaha. He met by chance in this effort a man named Harriman, E.H. Harriman, who had the Harriman Roads, one of which was the Illinois Central.
Famous in the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid scene, that the train's robbed. It's E.H. Harriman.
E.H. Harriman. Well, Harriman was one of the Eastern rail moguls. And these are the gentlemen that really did not want to see any substantial competition for roads that carried Midwestern traffic to the East Coast, to population centers in the East Coast. And so it was in connection with Harriman's acquaintanceship with Stillwell, when Stillwell needed money, that Harriman came on the board of the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Gulf Railroad, decided that there was something unacceptable about Stillwell's management. He was cast out. Harriman and his colleagues, Betta Million Gates, joined the company, and they changed the name, put the company in receivership, put the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Gulf in receivership, bought it out of receivership, and changed the name to the Kansas City Southern. So it is the Kansas City Southern is really the product of the Harriman initiative at the Kansas City property.
How did Arthur Stillwell take this being cast out after all these years of success and building and reaching the Gulf? And this man's a huge success, and here he is being booted off.
He's irrepressible. He's totally irrepressible.
Sort of like you, Lennon.
Watch it. Watch it. I think that really applies to you. But anyway, he decides that what he really always wanted was to connect Kansas City to the Gulf of California and to the Pacific Ocean. Mm-hmm. And he has a design for a railroad that goes west out of Kansas City through San Angelo, Texas, all the way to Tupolumbampo, on the Mexican coast, deep water port found by some German farmers, the best deep water port on the Pacific side of Mexico. And he goes to Diaz. Remember this famous, terrible dictator of Mexico. And Diaz gives Stilwell the exclusive rights to build this railroad from, in essence, the border, the Texas-Mexican border, across Mexico, the Copper Canyon, all those wonderful places some of your listeners have heard about and maybe seen.
He did that. Why? Why did he give this to Arthur Stilwell? What's in it for him?
Stilwell was a charmer. My goodness, he was. He went to him and said, you need to have this traffic from the Pacific into North America. You can do it from Tupolumbampo. We'll serve it'll be a great feather in your cap, Diaz. Arthur's underway. He starts the railroad. He's underway when it turns out that Diaz is the victim of a revolution. So Diaz is cast out. Many of the people that worked for Arthur in building the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Orient Railroad this time. And he finds out that many of the employees of the Diaz Railroad have turned traitor. And one of them, who had been a superintendent on the system, began to tear up the railroad that he had built for Arthur. His name was Pancho Villa, a very famous, not only a famous railroad employee, but also a famous bandito.
Yes, he was.
But the combination of these personalities is really one of the most startling things about innovators in the late 19th century, the Gilded Age, up to World War I, when things kind of went to pieces.
Well, he overcomes his problems in Mexico at some point, and he really lays the foundation for what is very much today the framework, the foundation for Kansas City Southern.
I think you're on the right track. It's sadly, he, of course, could not complete the railroad that he had designed with President Diaz, but the Santa Fe did, mm-hmm. and the Kemper family, we're lucky to have them here because they were awarded shares of the new Santa Fe Railroad as a fee for being the receiver for the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Orient Railroad.
Which really put the Kemper family on the map.
Well, I don't know about that. They had a lot of good instincts and
already
intelligence, so that they might have done this without the shares of the Santa Fe. But, of course, in this whole story of the Kansas City Southern, the discovery of oil in the Texas oil fields had a huge positive effect on the Kansas City Southern, because once that happened around Port Arthur, Kansas City Southern became, in the days before oil pipelines, became the means of bringing oil and petroleum products from the Gulf to the Midwest. Forest products, petroleum products, coal, northbound, grain and agricultural products, southbound, to the Gulf. Now, what I have recited to you in those last few words was the vision for a successful railroad.
Right.
But they were all adversely affected by the nationalization of roads in connection with World War I. You don't have time to listen to that. Arthur was dead by this time, but it had an enormous negative effect on all U.S. roads, coupled with the emergence of the technology for trucks in World War I. As we abandoned, in the course of World War I, equine transport for trucks of one kind or another, and after World War I, the bloom was on the truck, and the railroads had overstayed their welcome because they had been viewed as monopolists. They had been overregulated as a result of that activity, the Progressive Era. There were maximum rates, minimum rates for rails. They were very inflexible. They couldn't do the things they needed to do to keep the roads up. As a consequence, the railroads had to emerge from a new period of testing that ended really with deregulation in 1980.
Landon Roland is our guest. We're talking about the life and times of Arthur Stilwell, a pioneer railroading man in Kansas City who helped put this town on the map. If you want to join our conversation, you can do so right now, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate, at kcur.org or go to KCUR's Facebook page. So what kind of guy was he? You mentioned the word irrepressible, but if he was sitting here with us today, what's your sense of the man? What kind of guy would he be to hang out and have lunch with today, Landon?
Well, you know, it's awfully hard for us to envision the personality types of that really succeeded in the Gilded Age. If you can imagine the Gilded Age, just think about that term. Think about the life that you might imagine at Delmonico's in New York. You could imagine a somewhat flashy personality, mm-hmm. And at the same time, totally winning in his conviction that these things were going to happen. And that he could somehow facilitate them happening, whether it was employee saving, whether it was connection, ensuring connectivity around a city, whether it was simply finding access to new markets and new opportunities for markets. I think it would have been very hard to hold him down. If you think of the other things he did in Kansas City, he started a school for abandoned women and children in the West Bottoms. It was a very novel thing at mm-hmm. the time he did this. He started Fairmont Park because he thought that the employees of the railroad needed a place for recreation, and so there was a short line railroad going to that he put out. Maple Sugar Creek Railroad.
That was the worlds of fun of its time.
Worlds of fun of its time, and it was in that connection that he met Tom Bass, the great black horse trainer, you know, famous not only in the United States but in Europe, a very influential trainer, showed horses at Fairmont Park, came to see Arthur, said, "We need a horse show in Kansas City." Arthur says, "What can I do to help you?" So here is this guy bankrolling Arthur, wow. Tom Bass with essentially the first real professional horse show that we had that now is a part of the American Royal. But he was a guy that seemed to respond to initiatives of others so that he tried to make something happen. Now, most of the time this was pretty good, but it also took money. It took money and it took people who could execute on his dreams and his visions, and sometimes that got him in trouble.
How wealthy of a man was he?
You know, it never comes out. I don't think I know how much the man was worth at his peak. You know, you have these numbers about the value of a railroad that he created and he owned, you know, 50% of it or 10% or one thing and another. I don't think you really know because so many of those numbers about the value of properties was sort of transitory. And to a great extent, it was kind of like some of these housing bubbles. They were rail bubbles mm-hmm. that you did not know what ultimately the guy was going to walk away with. He was comfortable, certainly. He died living in a hotel in New York. The tragic story of his wife. He fell
very tragic
in an open elevator shaft in this hotel he lived in. The story was he walked into the elevator shaft. It was dark, and he didn't understand that there wasn't any car there, so he fell to his death. Not too much after his death, his wife, it said, some of this is, you know, a mythical kind of story. She is supposed to put on her best clothes, and she opened up the window, the balcony that they had in their home, and walked out on the balcony and said she was going to John Arthur and jumped off the balcony to her death. So that ended a remarkable man whose legacy is still a part of Kansas City. We have access, I'm convinced we have access to Mexico over the railroad to Kansas City Southern today, and Mike Haverty's done a fabulous job of putting
the current railroad
in place so that it really works. We have a unique cross-border railroad that connects us to world markets. If you look at the role that those markets on the west coast of Mexico are going to play in our own financial prosperity, imports from all the Asian Pacific Rim countries coming into ports on the coast of Mexico, all part of the Stilwell dream, all part of the Stilwell realization that ultimately as world markets developed, the United States was going to have access to those markets over ports and opportunities in Mexico. This was really bold thinking, and there are many examples of that you could talk about.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about railroading in Kansas City, the life of Arthur Stillwell with Landon Rowland. Coming up later this hour, Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list and Victor Wishna with a fan's notes. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation yesterday about presidential biographer Robert Dallek, you can visit kcur.org. Tomorrow reviews the latest art, foreign, and documentary films showing in area theaters. This hour, we're visiting with Landon Rowland about railroading in Kansas City and the life of Arthur Stillwell, a significant pioneer when it comes to putting this city on the map through its railroading. You know, he left Kansas City in 1908, Landon. Why and where did he go? Why did he wind up leaving Kansas City?
Well, we talked a little bit earlier, Steve, about his travails with the board members of the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Gulf. Harriman, Gates, another individual whose name escapes my mind now. These three men really ganged up on Stillwell, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Gulf in receivership, enabled the reorganization or the capture of the railroad by a new band of owners led by these men whose names I've mentioned. And Stillwell leaves. He comes back with this bold announcement about a new railroad into Mexico. There's some wonderful history about him coming to he organizes a dinner at a downtown club and announces this new investment opportunity, this new venture. And it was the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Orient Railroad that he was talking about. But his legacy, Steve, is rich in this country in this country because of his emphasis on such things as opening up these ports, the whole idea of connectivity around urban centers. Yeah. He was not stupid. He learned a lot from what our experience had been in the Civil War. The Civil War taught us a lot about how railroads had to be put together in order to serve larger transportation needs. That's what, in essence, he was doing by getting us to the Gulf of Mexico. And he was very lucky that luck is a big part of this with the petroleum, with the forest products, with the coal, et cetera.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to some phone calls now. We're joined now by railroad historian Peter Hansen, who wants to make some follow-up comments here. Peter, good morning. Nice to hear from you.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Peter.
This is a great topic of Kansas City history here, and just wanted to follow up on some of the points that Roland was making about the impact of Kansas City Southern on the local economy.
Right.
When it was completed, farmers in Kansas and Nebraska saw immediate additional profits of 80 cents an acre.
Wow.
Seats on the Kansas City Board of Trade, which were going for just $50 before Port Arthur, Texas was built, went to $3,600 within a year.
Wow.
Lumber from Louisiana and East Texas got shipped in all directions. It was the making of R.A. Long's fortune. And during the period from 1900 to 1910, Kansas City was actually the world's largest wholesale lumber market because all that southern lumber was coming up here and getting distributed out to the cities and towns that were building out on the Great Plains and beyond. And then lastly, you know, Stillwell just had this knack for building railroads and then having oil discovered along them just shortly after he got forced out. And it happened with Kansas City Southern because the Spindletop oil field in Texas was discovered just 4 years after the railroad was completed to Port Arthur. And then, as Landon has pointed out, oil was discovered along the Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient in Texas several years after Stillwell got forced out. So, he really did have an impact on the local economy.
Well, great comments, Peter. Landon, do you want to hop in?
No, I want to say, Peter, I'm just sorry you're not sitting here at my elbow. This is this would have been a great duo. Your financial and economic assessment is fabulous. And may I say this, none of those advantages have really disappeared for Kansas City as a focal point, as a node on an essential transportation system for our economy. And Stillwell's innovations, his good luck, all of that, we are inheriting that and enjoying it today.
Well, Peter, hang on just for a minute.
Absolutely.
Peter, hang on for a minute. I want to ask both of you a question here because, you know, I think a lot of people have always assumed that because, you know, Kansas City is so smack dab in the middle of the country, that our becoming a railroad hub was sort of part of our destiny from day one. And I'm wondering if that was the case or Landon, was it the fact that people like Arthur Stillwell came along to sort of make it happen?
Well, first of all, you have to say that, you know, none of this happens in a vacuum. There was a man named Van Horn that came here that even before the Civil War wanted very much to connect Kansas City to Chicago and Eastern points, thought that the city would not amount to anything. He was a part of the booster railroad community that existed all over the country. And he was the single person that got us the Quincy Railroad going to St. Joe. He gave us the bridge that gave us Eastern connections. And without Van Horn, I don't know that this city would have been attractive to Stillwell.
This is the bridge over the Missouri you're talking about.
The bridge over the Missouri.
Which may be the most pivotal moment in city history,
pivotal
right?
Moment. And you have to give Van Horn, this newspaper publisher, the credit for that. He, Hannibal, Quincy, Omaha, St. Joe Rally, Railroad, all of which so we've forgotten about how important this one railroad was because there was no connection to Kansas City until well into the late teens, the late part of the 19th century.
So if not for that bridge, Landon, then Leavenworth becomes the metropolitan area here instead of Kansas City.
St. Joe does, and the idea was we were not going to be a transcontinental railroad. Now, I don't know whether Peter, what your view about all this is.
Yeah,
but
Peter, hop in.
So I think you ought to have a word here because of your wonderful grasp of these facts.
Well, thanks. You're absolutely right. I mean, Kansas City was just one of several cities in the lower Missouri Valley that was vying for the right to build the first bridge over the river. Leavenworth, St. Joseph, Atchison, they were all in the running. And Kansas City was actually smaller than St. Joseph by far. The bridge was absolutely fundamental to the future destiny of Kansas City. And, Steve, you'll like this, because at the time that the bridge was finished in 1869, the Kansas City Weekly Times wrote that truly the future destiny of Kansas City has turned on this day.
Wow. Wow.
Well, you have to be careful that, as Peter knows, that you can attribute destiny to all kinds of singular events, but the context here is hugely important. We had these booster railroads coming out of Kansas City, coming out of all the towns that Peter mentioned, and it had to be somebody that came along at various stages, whether it was Van Horn or Stillwell, that put things together. And I'm convinced if you listen to Charlie Kimball's words of MRI fame, that this sort of atmosphere of innovation hangs over Kansas City. There are many examples of it. We tend to be on the back burner on a lot of things, but I think that Stillwell's legacy captured a lot in Charlie Kimball's focus on technology transfer management, which is still a focus of MRI. All of this comes together in a context that is largely forgotten, but should be remembered because it's an inspiration to a lot of young people like you, Steve.
Peter, hang on for this call, too. Keith from Blue Springs, you're on Up to Date. Good morning, Keith.
That's a great show. I was wondering if Mr. Rowland or the other gentleman that's on the phone could recommend any kind of reading material about Arthur Stillwell so we could explore it further.
Well, I think Landon Rowland's going to be writing the biography, the definitive biography here starting
today,
right?
I want to be careful about claiming definitive biography. Every time you pick up a newspaper, there's a new biography of somebody, and they're all covering more data because we have a way of digging deep. There is a website for L. Rowland at EvergladesFinancial.com that lists a lot of books and stuff that's easier for you to find than for me to recite them on the radio and there and embarrass these wonderful people at KCUR who have put this show on, and they don't want to have a bibliography reader on. And Peter Hansen may have some ideas about it too, but there is a rather long list of books and other materials you might find interesting. It's worth your study, totally worth your study. It'll inspire you.
We'll try to get Landon's email address on our web page here today at kcur.org. Go ahead, Peter.
Landon himself wrote a very nice monograph that can be found online about Arthur Stillwell. And I don't know, my feeling is that probably some of the best works about him, there was a university professor by the name of Keith Bryant,
yes,
who wrote a book several years ago called Arthur Stillwell, Promoter with a Dream. And then there are Stillwell's own memoirs, which make for interesting reading. He had his memoirs serialized in the Saturday Evening Post under the title I Had a Hunch. And so all of those, I think, are very interesting reads. And, you know, I have to agree with Landon. I mean, some of this stuff is really inspiring.
Hmm. Peter, I'm sure glad you called in. Thanks for the phone call. And, Keith, good luck to you. Thank you both very much.
See you on Sunday.
Yeah. Again, he's talking about he'll be speaking a week from Sunday on March 18th at 2 p.m. at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the one downtown, the branch of 14 West 10th Street. So what's the future of railroading here in this country, Landon? Just before we go out here, 50 years from now, are railroads and trains still going to be as active as they are right now?
They're indispensable.
Okay.
We have a highway system that is basically taken for granted. It's in terrible shape. We have infrastructure deficits that nobody wants to talk about, not only for the nation, but for counties and cities. No way for us to deal with this. The railroads reinvest every day. Every day, railroads reinvest in their physical plant, their physical equipment. You can't find that with other systems where you have an ownership of the physical pathway that you are responsible for maintaining. Too often, we depend on the government to find the pathway, build it, and maintain it. The railroads, as long as they maintain their focus on self-preservation and service, and again, there will be some interesting comments on this infrastructure issue a week from Sunday,
right.
And some of that applies to some very important changes. The railroads continue to innovate in ways that serve the shipping public and our place in a global economy.
Well, Lennon, I enjoyed having you. Thanks for the update on the life and times of Arthur Stillwell. Again, listeners can go here and see Landon Roland a week from Sunday, March 18th, 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street.